Atheist Nomads, episode 373. American Atheist with Nick Fish.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and in a little bit, I'll be joined by Nick Fish, the president of American Atheists. And we make mention of the biggest news story of the last week, but we were recording on Saturday, and obviously wasn't the main point of the interview, so it was mentioned, but not really gone into all that in depth, because in all practicality, even though it was a big deal, it didn't really change what was already going on for American Atheists and their shift in focus that we'll hear about in a little bit. And that news, of course, is the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The most solid member of the Supreme Court to stand up for women's rights, gay rights, and secular values. And that's sad. That is really sad. She's one of the greatest legal minds in American history. She has written some of the best opinions. She has an amazing legacy. And all of that will probably be undone by whoever will soon be nominated to replace her. There was still hope on Saturday when Nick and I talked that the Republicans might hold to their statements of even just 2 years ago, that they set the precedent in 2016 that presidents cannot nominate Supreme Court justices during election years. And anybody who actually ever believed that is a fool. This has all been part of Mitch McConnell's ploy one of his many plots. He's had quite a few. Even when Republicans had a minority in the Senate, McConnell employed the filibuster enough on judicial nominees for Schumer to invoke the nuclear option and get rid of filibuster on judicial nominees who aren't Supreme Court for the Supreme Court. That at least allowed them to get some judges pushed through during Obama's presidency. Once McConnell got majority leader, that pretty much stopped Obama being able to appoint judges. A few got through, but not many. And that was 2014. That made it so that Trump was able to appoint more judges in 3 years than Barack Obama got to appoint in 8. That drastically reshaped the federal judiciary from being almost entirely made up of legal scholars and experienced judges who try their best to apply the law in a way that is fair, to conservative ideologues whose only goal is to bend the law to their ideology. Between McConnell refusing to hold hearings to confirm Merrick Garner's nomination in 2016, March of 2016, that has made it so that Trump has gotten 2 justices on the Supreme Court, and now he will get a 3rd. Also, greatly reshaping the Supreme Court. I've seen this commonly referred to kind of scale that justices are on, with 0 being completely far left wing liberal and 100 being completely far right wing conservatives. And when Trump took office, well, actually, I guess more accurately would be Before 2016, there was 5 conservative justices and 4 liberal justices. Ruth Bader Ginsburg being the most liberal justice, being at around an 11 or 13 on that 100-point scale. And Anthony Kennedy tended to be the tiebreaker, the swing vote, coming in at about a 75. Since his death, and Trump getting to appoint 2 Federal Society picks, that has moved the swing point, the fulcrum, to about a 97. With Trump getting another pick, the fulcrum moves to about 99 out of 100. It means for anything other than a far right-wing activist judicial opinion to come out of the Supreme Court means having to pick off 2 of the conservatives. That means having to get both Roberts and Gorsuch. That means shaming Roberts and trying to find some bizarre way to force Gorsuch to clearly follow the exact way a law was written, because he's a very strict textualist. And that's a really hard, to try to get both is really hard. The future for church-state separation has already been looking bleak, as we've been moving far away from actual separation to accommodation of religion at every step possible. And with the fulcrum of the court moving all the way to about 99, there's nothing to say that the Establishment Clause won't be basically obliterated. And this sucks, especially when you look at how young of judges Trump keeps appointing. This really sucks. The reforms that would be necessary to fix this will require that Joe Biden be elected president and that Democrats maintain control of the House and take the Senate. Those are all possible if people get out and vote. And those reforms needed to fix this are huge. Absolutely huge. And they're the kind of reforms that could get a pretty strong backlash. But those might be the kind of backlash needed for the bullshit the Republicans have been playing for the last 12 fucking years. It sucks, and to be honest, my optimism is not there right now. And the only silver lining I can find in all of it is that this needs to be a reminder that we all need to take our own local politics more seriously. As protections in the federal courts go away, as federal protections get struck down, we need stronger state protections. When a 6-3 conservative court overturns Obergefell, we're going to need states to enact their own, more and more states to enact their own laws legalizing same-sex marriage. Most states didn't actually enact any laws. They just had to comply with a Supreme Court ruling. When that goes away, the old laws go back into effect. And we will need action at the state level to undo that. If a 6-3 conservative court overturns Roe versus Wade, we will need abortion rights to be protected at the state level. Because if Roe goes away, it goes back to the way it was before that, where each state got to pick and choose. And about half of states had legal abortion, and the other half either had a lot of women driving across state lines or women going to the hospital after botched coat hanger abortion attempts. or is it going to require action at the state level? And the fortunate thing is it's often easier to make changes at the state level. Your representatives represent a lot fewer people. And state representatives have a lot fewer corporate sponsors. They're a lot closer to the people and are a lot more responsive. They are people you are more likely to be able to actually sit down and talk to than your federal representatives. So get involved at the local level and the state level. And we need to make the changes there. We need to preserve the progress that has been made. The progress that Ruth Bader Ginsburg helped bring about at the local level. Which segues nicely to the interview. We are now joined by Nick Fish, the president of American Atheists. Nick, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, one thing that's kind of handy is with your organization, it doesn't require as much introduction as some, so...
My reputation precedes me. It's always, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But we'll call it a good thing for now.
Well, it's an organization that's been around for, you know, pretty much forever at this point.
1963. We've been here a while, that's for sure.
Yeah. And, let's start with... you're the president, and you have been for what, about 2 years now?
2 years. It's actually 2 years as of like next week, I think.
Oh wow. Okay. And so, what changes have you made has the organization made since you took over?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of I don't know exactly when this is going to go out, but it's sort of interesting.
Thursday.
So, you know, we're recording this on Saturday, which is the day after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. She died on Friday evening. And one of the things that we had talked about as part of the strategic planning that we did when I became president was thinking about the ways that we can most affect policy in the United States. We're really concerned about the courts, I think, for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. That we're really faced with a challenge right now that the Trump administration has confirmed more than 200 lifetime federal judges. Judges wow. at both the district court, circuit court level, two judges at the Supreme Court, and now there's another opening at the Supreme Court. And the question just is, how effective can we be with litigation right now? And where is it most effective for us to devote our resources? And, mm-hmm. you know, this is a trend that we've been faced with for quite some time, that the types of cases that we used to bring, certainly around the Establishment Clause, just don't have the teeth that they used to. It's much harder for us to win some of these cases at trial court and certainly on appeal. And the Trump administration has made it even more difficult by some of the people that they've appointed. I mean, Neil Gorsuch was actually on the panel that ruled in our favor on the Utah cross cases, where the Utah government was putting up these giant crosses to honor any state troopers who had died mm-hmm. In Utah. And this was a case back in the early 2000s, and we sued and we won. We won it on appeal in that circuit court. And he dissented. He said that, you know, that just putting up a giant cross is not a religious symbol, which is, you know, crazy.
Right.
But it's exactly now what we have from the Supreme Court in the Bladensburg cross case, mm-hmm. that the American Humanist Association brought and won at lower levels because obviously a cross is a is a giant Christian symbol, but it made its way to the Supreme Court, and you know, and they lost. And so those sorts of cases are much harder to bring. The cases that deal with things that we thought would be slam dunks, you know, Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue, which was from this last term, about direct funding of religious schools by the government. And mm-hmm. can the government say, you know what, we actually don't want to do these types of programs at all. We're just going to stop doing this program, which is what Montana did. Montana didn't single out religious schools for any sort of disparate treatment. They said, we're not going to do this program at all. And what the Supreme Court said, and this is, you know, just a baffling decision, is no, you can't do that. You can't stop this program. And so we're left kind of wondering, well, what is off limits here?
And with Montana, you've got a lot of the states around, because I'm in Idaho, And in the Idaho Constitution, there is a very specific clause saying that basically absolutely no government funds can go to any kind of religious organization, entity, or school. And most of these states that got statehood around that same time as Idaho did, so like Montana, all have that because there were Mormons trying to colonize all of these states, and they were afraid of Mormons taking over and getting funding from the state and just didn't want that to happen.
Right. Well, and there's a history to these too, and that's kind of what the Supreme Court went to, or what certain it's a complicated decision because it's got the opinion of the court and then like three concurrences and three dissents. So it's a little bit like mixed up. There's a lot of reasoning that's out there, but you know, they said that there's anti-Catholic, and that's the problem. Is it's like it's not anti-Catholic. They sort of discount the idea that wanting a separation of church and state, wanting taxpayer money to go to services that are accessible to all taxpayers, that they think that that's not somehow a legitimate reason to want to do something, that it must be motivated by anti-Catholic or anti-religious animus. I think it was Samuel Alito literally said that even using the word sectarian was an indication of animus against religion, which is just insane.
What?
And so that's the environment that we're in. And you know, this term, we have a case called Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, which deals with the City of Philadelphia has requirements around their contracting. It says, if you're going to do business with the city, you can't discriminate, which makes complete sense. You can't discriminate against LGBT people. You can't discriminate in the way that you provide services. Well, the City of Philadelphia found out that a Catholic service provider for adoptions and foster care was discriminating and said, okay, you know, we're not going to renew your contract. You're free to do that, but we're not going to renew your contract to provide these services through the city. Mm-hmm. And they sued. And they said, they point to like two or three statements that are completely just benign from members of the city's government, where one of them said something like, we welcome this new Pope and we hope, you know, like we're looking forward to a tone change on some issues. Right. One of them said when a new archbishop was installed in Philadelphia, essentially said, we hope we can work with this new archbishop and we're really, you know, excited to see, you know, a change there. And like saying basically, we're excited to work with the Catholic Church and we were just completely innocuous statements taken out of context to say that this was, again, somehow evidence of animus against Catholics, which is just insane. So like that's the environment that we're in right now. And even with Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the court, no one knew what was going to happen with Fulton. Everyone was kind of, you know, planning for the worst, hoping for the best. But now, you know, even if the lower court, or even if it's 4-4, the lower court ruling would stand, which isn't the worst thing. But at the same time, I don't know that it'll be 4-4. This is one case where it may just be 5-3 when we would lose anyway. But so we looked at all of that. We looked at the environment, the legal environment. We said we have to rethink how we approach some of these cases. And that's why the cases that we're bringing right now focus much more on free speech, focus on people being able to engage in the public sphere. So one of the cases in active litigation that we have right now is in Arkansas with a state senator who has said explicitly, I maintain a block list of atheists and progressives, but you know, the side that we're most concerned about are atheists, and preventing them from engaging in the modern day public square of a comment section of his social media. Mm-hmm. So people who said would comment on his social media posts and say, Senator, your job is to represent all of us, not to just be not to just represent your Christian constituents, and they would get blocked. And they respectfully engaging, they're not doing anything, you know, they're not swearing, they're not doing any of the things that you can actually be blocked for on social media by a elected official. And he admits that he did it because they're atheists. And so we, you know, told him that his constituents have a right to engage and to speak with him. And he said, no. And so we've been suing him for a while now. That case has been going on for the better part of a year and a half. And, you know, it's still out there and is I think, an interesting approach, is something that is kind of in line with what groups like the Knight Center at Columbia have been doing with the Trump Twitter case, just protecting people's right to engage. I think that's a core part of what we as American atheists want our constituents to be able to do is to be seen and to be heard and to be visible in these conversations that are happening in cities and towns and states all across the country, to normalize atheism, to make it easier to be an atheist in America. That's part of it, is being seen and being able to engage and have that discourse. But on the programmatic side, the way that we've pivoted toward where we're investing more of our resources, more of our money, is at the local level, is training groups to get out there and either, you know, engage on political matters, lobby, go out there and tell their elected officials what issues matter to them, why they should pass a bill or not pass a bill, how it affects them, gathering those stories, gathering those facts and figures so that they can be more effective advocates for what's happening. Because quite frankly, a lot of the things that most impact your life in the day-to-day do not happen in Washington, D.C. They happen in your state capitol, or they happen, you know, in your town. They happen at the school board. They happen at the city council meetings. Mm-hmm. Those are the types of things where a small group of people can really make a big difference, whether it's passing ordinances that prohibit discrimination on the basis of religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, and so on. And if you pass that, making sure there's not religious exemptions in it, whether it's banning child marriage, which is something we've actually been very successful mm-hmm. in all across the country, banning or getting rid of religious exemptions to vaccination requirements, getting rid of religious exemptions to closing churches and whatnot for, let's say, a pandemic, something like that. Yeah. Those are things that people can really affect at the local level, where the federal government isn't reaching in and doing anything about it. So people can be extremely effective in moving the needle in a relatively short amount of time at the local level. And it gives people an opportunity to set an example or to create a pathway forward for other states. So we can pass, it's relatively easy for things to get passed in, you know, in New Jersey here where we're located. It's not easy. It's easier, I guess I should say. Mm-hmm. but people can look at that and say, oh, you know what? That's actually a good idea. We can do something like that here in Pennsylvania. And then from Pennsylvania, Nevada, and then from Nevada, Idaho, right? Like that step can happen, and it does happen. And it happens on, as I said, issues like female genital mutilation and child marriage. Like, those are things that we've actually been very successful in passing state laws prohibiting or closing loopholes, getting rid of religious exemptions, and doing it with partners.
Idaho has been having bills lately for getting rid of child marriage. And you want to guess why they keep dying?
Why do they keep dying? Religious exemptions.
Parental rights.
Yeah.
Parental rights.
Yeah, to marry off your children. Yeah, I mean, that's the issue, right? Is some of these have, so what we've said and what the United Nations has said and what advocates who work in the space say on the child marriage issue is essentially having any exemptions here puts kids at risk, mm-hmm. especially if it's a religious exemption or if it's a parental permission. You can get around the whole thing with parental permission. I don't know many, you know, 15-year-olds who are running out to get married who are doing it for reasons other than religious or because their parents are pressuring them into it. And so saying, you know, oh, you can do it as long as it's a religious reason or as long as your parents are giving you permission, that doesn't really solve the problem. And, you know, the problem isn't just the marriage, it's what happens afterward. And this is where, you know, the terrible stories that we've collected and that we're trying to tell to lawmakers about why this matters. Like, this is where it really resonates, is people will get married at 15 and then it will go terrible. You know, they want out, and it's, you know, it's awful. And these women, almost always girls who have gotten married, who are younger, and they're married usually to people, much older men, they'll try to leave. Well, if they try to leave at 17, for example, they're not able to access the court system that allows them to like file divorces,
right,
or access social services for the children that they've now had in the 2.5 or 3 years of marriage that they've been married. They can't access any of those services because those services require you to be of the age of majority. Mm-hmm. So you're old enough to be married, you're old enough to have children, you're not old enough to choose to end that marriage or to access the resources that would help you do that. And that's what these girls and now women have told us is, you know, this is the problem with this is it's not just the marriage. It's not just the, you know, psychological damage and all the lack of educational opportunities that happen in many of these insular communities when people are married off like this. It's if you try to escape, there's nothing you can do. Right. And you're stuck in the situation. You're stuck in just, you know, this hell for until you at least turn 18. And even then it's difficult because you have no social support. You know, your whole community is often very insular and wrapped up in this idea of child marriage. And so just preventing it at the outset is the most effective thing we can do. And again, it's we've been successful in it. I think it's up to 6 states or 7 states now, where 3 years ago it was 1, and that's pretty good. And so we're making progress, but it and building some consensus with partners and finding people to work with. But that's been an uphill battle, but it's been something we've been winning on. Yeah. And it literally will save people's lives. I mean, this is something that is, you know, that people are stunned to learn still exists in the United States.
Well, Idaho did at least get a change in the law to set a minimum age.
Right.
So now you have to be at least 16.
Yeah.
Before there was no minimum.
Exactly. Yeah. Some states were, there was a limit, but it was 13. And it's like, what's going on here? Who thought this was a good idea? When was this passed? You know? And then, to your point. That was one state that did not have a limit. And, you know, we looked at that and said, okay, 16, we're not going to back this. We're not going to say, great, you've solved the problem, but heck, we'll take a slight improvement here, but, not great.
And if I'm remembering correctly, it's, for a 16 or 17 year old to get married requires parental consent and a judge to sign off.
Yeah. That's usually how it is. Yeah. And you know, the judge signing off, the question is always how deeply do they dig in? And, you know, we get back to anti-religious animus, which is the new question in a lot of the court stuff is if a judge says, hey, listen, it seems to me that you're marrying off your child because of some insular, slightly strange religion that I'm not too comfortable with, where you're marrying off your 16-year-old child to a 35-year-old man because he's a prophet of some kind. I mean, this isn't like a hypothetical. This is what's happening. And I'm not okay with that. Well, did he exhibit anti-religious animus? Okay, well, then we have to throw out the whole thing. And, you know, they just won a civil rights lawsuit. And so the easiest way to do this, and this is what we've maintained from the get-go, is that we don't want the government sort of picking and choosing, you know, is this an acceptable example of a 16-year-old getting married? Is this not? We'd much rather just say, if you're an adult, you can get married. Mm-hmm. If you're not, just wait a little bit, you know, get engaged. you can have your engagement ring. Don't get married yet. You know?
Right. And, but it should be reasonable for a court to consider whether or not somebody in Idaho is a Mormon fundamentalist who's planning on this is just going to be the first child bride. The rest just won't be legal. A court should be able to look at that.
I agree. But the point is that that is, if it were to be appealed, they could make a pretty strong case for anti-religious animus to say that you're punishing people, you're treating them differently because of their religion. And that's where we're at, right? In federal court right now. Where if like that's an argument that can be made and they might win. Hmm. And so the better solution is just to say, all right, no child marriages. And so we're going to set that aside. And you know, the problem with a lot of this is obviously, you know, I would think that, and I think many in our community would say, yes, of course a judge should be able to make that call. The problem though is, just from a principle standpoint, if you're saying, do you want the government involved in telling people what is and what is not a legitimate expression of faith or a legitimate expression of religion, we start getting into some really hairy situations where, you know, the people, something like the Satanic Temple, you know, comes along and says, you know, this is a legitimate expression of our faith is to say that the body is sacrosanct and you can't tell someone not to have an abortion, right? That you can't impose all these restrictions on women who are seeking abortion. What's happened is the court has come back and said, well, you're not a real religion and that's not a genuine expression of your faith. And like that's why in some of those cases where you try to kind of turn the tables around and say, we're going to use these kind of RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act style laws, we're going to claim a religious exemption. The problem when you do that is that most of the time, the courts say, well, you're not even a real religion anyway. The only real religion is Christianity, basically. You know, this this expression of faith, this type of religious belief, the belief that, for example, abortion is bad and, you know, gay people are icky, right? Those are the only two types of religious expression that have really been protected by the courts lately. All this other stuff, well, too bad. You know, if you're a business owner who thinks that blood transfusions are sinful, or you're a Christian scientist and you think that all medical treatment is sinful and you can only do faith healing, there aren't any courts out there right now that are saying, well, the Affordable Care Act doesn't apply to you at all, or doesn't apply, you can't, you know, you're allowed to go purchase insurance that doesn't cover blood transfusions. You know, they kind of look at that and rightly say, well, that's a bridge too far. Mm-hmm. But they then turn around and say, well, this very sincerely held belief that contraception causes abortion, which it doesn't, that's a sincerely held belief. And we can't possibly, you know, dig in. And the fact that they clearly sincerely believe it is more than enough. You know, that's all we need. We can't dig in on the factual basis of it and if people will actually be harmed or if their belief is true. All that matters is they believe it. And by the way, this is literally what was said for the like Hobby Lobby sort of series of cases, yeah, where they said, yeah, their sincere belief was that a particular type of birth control caused abortion, even though it doesn't. The fact that they believed it was enough, and the court can't get in there and suss apart whether or not their belief is true. That's not the place for the court. That was what the majority ruling was in that case. But that only seems to hold true for sort of evangelical Christians, Catholics, and mainline Protestants. If you're a member of some weird, goofy cult, then mm-hmm. we're going to say, oh, yeah, no, we can't do that. And so it's a really unprincipled position that the other side has painted themselves into.
So if you have the same beliefs as the people deciding the case,
yeah,
then of course a corporation can have a religion.
Yep, exactly. But if you're a member of some smaller religion, if you're, you know, one of these religions that believes in child marriage or that, you know, believes that blood transfusions are sinful or that psychology, you know, if you're a Scientologist and you think that, you know, psychology or psychiatry is, you know, the worst thing ever, then you're a weird cult and we're not going to give you a religious exemption. And so what we've created now is this like three-tiered system where you have people at the top who are part of this majority or larger religious groups that have some legitimacy. And they are the ones that get special treatment. And it's usually, if you notice, around issues of human sexuality. So it has to do with, yep, you know, whether or not women are just, you know, birthing chambers that carry children to term. Like that's one of them. The other one is around LGBT issues. So those are sort of the two things that mm-hmm. are set above. The next level are people who are of these religions who often have a genuine religious belief. I mean, you know, I'm not going to question the legitimacy of the belief for the Christian Scientists and the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Scientologists and the, or even the people who, you know, the Native Americans. I mean, this whole like series of cases started with Native Americans wanting to be able to smoke peyote mm-hmm. as a religious sacrament. And, you know, we ended up with Employment Division versus Smith, where Justice Scalia said, no, the court or the government can certainly regulate drug use, even if it's a religious thing, because it applies to everybody. Tough cookies, you need to deal with it. And then we got RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, because of that. And that's like that was sort of the initial domino in this whole series. And then we have atheists and we have people who are non-religious who just can't make these claims at all and are kind of left out saying, okay, you have to follow the law no matter what, even if you don't like it. You can't even really make these arguments. They're not accessible to you, which is, you know, a problem. But so this is all to say that, you know, the court system and the rules, and I'm using rules and sort of scare quotes here, around many of these issues are just kind of being made up as we go. And it's so hard to turn around and say, you know, here's how we fight back against this in the courts. And so the biggest change that we made coming in was a more conscious focus on state law and on state legislation and on local and state activism, because we just think it's a more effective way for us to get out there and change the law and change the way that people are experiencing the law in their day-to-day lives.
So I mean, bottom up. Yeah.
I mean, every once in a while you have a case, you know, like Windsor or like Obergefell, or, you know, like any of those cases that just, you know, is earth shattering and it quote unquote fixes a lot of things all at once. Those are much more rare than they once were. And
that's why we can name them.
Right. And there are just as many ones on the, that are just, that are bad, that are on the other side, that really shake the foundation of some stuff that we thought we knew about American law right now. Certainly the case in Montana, the Espinoza versus Montana, was certainly one of those that just fundamentally shook what we thought we understood about, and what we knew about American law and about the limits of government funding of religion, and just turned it on its head. And the fact that the decision itself is so bad, means that we don't actually know yet what the ramifications are. There are very few clear instructions in that case of how to proceed, of what this looks like now. So, and that's then, that's where we're at.
So does a case that vague really create precedent?
Oh, yeah. The problem is we just don't know what. And so what can happen is you end up with district courts and circuit courts kind of taking it and saying, well, this clearly justifies my position. And then everyone going, does it? And then we end up with more and more cases kind of making their way through the system because nobody knows what it really says. Nobody knows how the Supreme Court is really going to rule at the end of the day. And you're going to end up with different circuits reading Espinoza differently. Different circuits, you know, looking at it and saying, well, because you didn't create something and then your state Supreme Court didn't repeal it or didn't strike it down as a violation of this. Like, we just don't know. We have no clue what these are going to look like. And as you said, kind of at the top of this conversation, 30 some odd states have these no aid clauses. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing for states to have some version of it. But we just don't know. And that's not a good place for the law to be, where you don't know on any given day what should be a very simple question. Can state governments directly fund religious schools? Like that should be a very simple question, but we don't know. We don't know the answer to that right now.
And so then some states will start more directly funding religious schools.
I think so, yeah. Ooh. And if somebody sues, are they going to win? We don't know. Do they even have standing? I mean, that's another question. That's like sort of the complicated thing that nobody talks about, except those of us that are nerds about this and spend way too many of our waking hours thinking about it, is how do you even access the courts in the first place? Federal courts have so narrowed what's called standing, the ability to bring the suit, to the point where it's very unclear if when some of these things are being violated. When people look at just something very clearly and is privileging religion or giving special treatment on the basis of religion, and they say, that's unconstitutional, you guys should sue over it. Well, the first question is, well, who has standing? Who can bring the suit? Who is being harmed by this in a articulable way where we can point to it and say, this is an actual harm that a person has suffered? People like who are on the president's short list for the Supreme Court, and Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch and Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito have all articulated varying degrees of this, basically saying, hey, listen, if you're not being physically harmed by this, you don't have standing. Encountering a religious monument on public land is not harm to them. So if your city decides to put up a giant cross on your city hall and it's donated and somebody's paying to keep it up, there's no money changing hands, but they say nobody else is going to put this up. Somebody donated this. There's no money changing hands, but it's there. It's on your city councils or on your town halls building. And it's just a giant cross. they would say, you have not been harmed, so you can't show, you can't even access the courts for us to say that this is or is not a violation of the Establishment Clause, because you have not been physically harmed by it. And even, and there are some of them that are taken even more extreme, that say taxpayer standing. So if you're a person who is a taxpayer and the money is sort of goes to a general fund, and then out of that, they have discretion on where to spend it. If it's something like that, you also don't have standing. I mean, that's a rising view for some in this area of the law as well. And what you're left with is this situation where nobody can challenge these things that are plainly unconstitutional, or should be plainly unconstitutional, but nobody can bring the lawsuit. And so we're left with this question of, how do we vindicate our rights? Well, if the courts aren't going to do it, we have to do it through popular means.
With all of this, would you say that it's a... are you retreating or are you regrouping?
Well, I don't know if it's either. I think what it is just a change in tactics. It's recognizing that one approach is not going to be the way to most effectively use our time, use our money, use our folks' resources. And two, it's just a better way of building a more sustainable community. It's a way of building something that is going to thrive for years to come, is giving people opportunities to get involved in their communities, to use this sort of popular, I guess you can call it almost like a popular approach, rather than this, you know, legal, you know, only lawyers can really access this type of activism. We want people to be more engaged in the type of society that they want to build. And part of that is getting out there and just being active. And there are ways of doing that that really, like I said, build a sustainable community. What we found is that people who are part of an atheist group or any type of community group that scratches a few of those itches, so gives them an opportunity for socializing and building that sort of social support network where if something happens, they have a group of people they can turn to, a group that, you know, gets out there and does good in the community, whether that be through providing direct service, working at food banks, you know, whatever that may be. And then groups that get out there and do activism. They do protests, they, you know, go meet with their elected officials, their members of Congress, their local officials, groups that can do all three of those things, even if it's in like wildly different balances, but, you know, that take part in all three of those things are much more successful for the long run. And on top of that, people who are members of those groups tend to have better outcomes in a number of metrics that we look at. We just did the U.S. Secular Survey, which was the largest data collection project of people in our community that's ever been done. We had almost 35,000 people participate in that. Our original goal was to have between 5,000 and 10,000, and we hit that. we hit that in like literally a couple of hours.
Oh wow!
And we ended up, the original field period for the study was supposed to be a couple weeks. We ended up closing, or it was, I think, 3 weeks. We ended up closing it in like 10 days because we hit so many people who had a story to tell and wanted us to learn more about them, and it was fantastic. That we just said, okay, we have enough data, we can analyze this now, and we did, and it's been a very helpful tool so far, and we're really just scratching the surface of it. But what we found is that people in our community who are not members of local groups, that don't have that sort of like that type of outlet, showed much higher likelihood to experience depression or screened positive for depression. We're obviously not diagnosing them with depression, but they had indications that would be consistent with experiencing depression or other mental health concerns that are not great for people, that really present a challenge. But that being a member of these types of groups, that having supportive friends and family, people that they could turn to, and being a member of one of these groups insulated them from many of the harms that we saw, especially for people who were located in highly religious communities, particularly in the South and the kind of Mountain West area, so kind of where you are, that people who live in those communities, especially rural communities in those areas, highly religious rural communities, just really had a hard go at it. They experienced tons of stigma. They experienced discrimination at much higher levels. They experienced sort of stigmatizing behavior from people in all parts of their life, whether it be education, in interactions with the government, interactions with the police, healthcare, employment, family, just every area of life. They had a much higher likelihood of experiencing that type of discrimination. But that being part of a vibrant group that goes out there and does things that are akin to what you would see from many other types of community groups was an insulating factor and really helped improve outcomes for folks. And so we want to foster that type of environment for as many people as possible and give them the resources to be effective at creating that type of community group. And by doing so, again, we're helping the people, yes, but we're also helping the community by getting people trained and able and equipped to go out there to change the world for the better. You know, it sounds kind of hokey to say, yeah, but to change their city for the better, which is, you got to start somewhere. And having a city that doesn't have a bunch of religious exemptions and doesn't privilege religion in that way is a great starting point. A city that where the school board, you know, isn't putting abstinence-only sex ed into public schools and isn't teaching creationism. I mean, those are unquestionably good things that we need more of. And we need people who are out there and able and excited to fight for that stuff. And thankfully, we have hundreds, thousands of really great volunteers throughout the country that are just eager to go out there and do it. And especially, you know, we obviously, it's impossible to ignore the reality on the ground at the federal level, that nothing is happening really to move the ball forward and advance equality in Congress, or certainly in the administration. That we've attempted multiple times to raise these concerns. We, every single time, the Department of Health and Human Services, or the Department of Education, or the Department of Justice, or any of these agencies that weigh in on these types of issues, anytime that happens, we reach out, we take a meeting with them, we raise our concerns, and they do exactly the opposite of what we ask. they don't, you know, and that's just how it is. And so we need to find opportunities for people to change things one step at a time, and to realize where we can make that change. And you know, the fact is that it's at the local level that we can be most effective.
Okay. Well, and there are other organizations that are still doing that. You know, we talked recently with Casey from Secular Coalition for America.
Right.
And he's talking to people in Congress all the time.
Yep.
And FFRF will continue to file lawsuits. Right.
And I don't want to pretend for a moment that these things are not helpful. They are.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's only so much that can be done in those areas. And if we're asking people to, you know, support us, like, what are we adding? What value are we adding to the community? What are we doing that's different from what our partners are doing? And are we just replicating the stuff that FFRF does really well, or that the Secular Coalition does really well? Well, we don't want to just do the same thing. We need to do something different and fill a niche that isn't being filled elsewhere. And that's what we really thought focusing on the state level and focusing on the grassroots was. It's an opportunity to add something that wasn't being covered in the way that we wanted it to. And that's, you know, that's the best way of making change, is collaborating with those groups, and then us going out and filling in the gaps, and, you know, kind of acknowledging where we have expertise and where other groups have expertise and where they have capacity. And so the fact that we, divide and conquer actually means the other thing, where you divide the group and then beat them all. So I don't want to talk
about that. That's not quite right.
Put your resources where they're most effective, and where and so that no area of the law, no area of American society is going unchallenged by our community. And we all do all of these things. We all file lawsuits, right? Mm-hmm. FFRF, American Humanist Association, American Atheists, we all file lawsuits. But FFRF certainly does more of them, and a different type of them. AHA does a few, we do a few, FFRF does a lot. On the lobbying side, on meeting with members of Congress, the Secular Coalition does a lot of that. FFRF does some of it. We do some of it. AHA does some of it. But even there, we focus on different areas of the law. So Secular Coalition and FFRF will meet with members of Congress. They'll work with the Congressional Freethought Caucus. American Atheists and Center for Inquiry focus a lot on matters related to the administration. So what we call administrative law, areas where you're talking about regulations coming out of federal agencies. AHA does a lot with international issues and blasphemy. And we've kind of divvied these things up, not like these aren't hard and fast rules, but we coordinate on these things. We talk about what we're each going to work on. And I'll say, you know, I've been working in this community for a decade. The level of collaboration and, you know, the work that happens behind the scenes is better now than it ever has been. People, the collaboration and just the willingness to put our heads down and get the work done, and to not have our egos get in the way and just be willing to go out there and do what's best for the cause is better than I've ever seen it. And it's truly heartening, and, you know, it's great to see. And then, you know, as I said, on the state level, American Atheist has a lot going on at the state level, and we track legislation all across the states. And then FFRF and CFI will do some of that as well, but we're sort of the leaders on that area. And so we found these niches that work for us and that we have expertise on and that we can add something to the conversation. And that's what's really important is, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel every single time something comes up. We have people with expertise on the issues, and we've built that in, and we talk with one another constantly about what's going to happen next and who's going to take what and how we're going to focus our time and our energy.
All right. Yeah, that's a smart way of handling it.
And I thought so.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, over the last, 15 years or so, American Atheists have shifted focus several times. And this kind of sounds like it's shifting back towards where it all started, to an extent.
Yeah, the history of American Atheists is, yeah, complicated. I mean, one of the original things that, and this go back even more than 15 years ago, is you adapt to what's going on. You know, we're never going to shift away from our core focus that about talking about atheism and building a community that represents atheists across all different stripes in the United States, and, you know, being critical of religious exemptions and fighting to protect the absolute separation of church and state. That's going to continue to be the core focus of our work, and that will never change. The thing that changes is how that finds expression, how we go out there and say this is the best way to implement that vision and to fight for that. Sometimes it's in the courts. Sometimes it's in DC. Sometimes it's in states throughout the country. But we've built a team here at American Atheists that I think reflects our vision and our values and our commitment to supporting local activism. That there's just so much ripe for the taking there that it's nuts for us not to do it. There's so much work that can be done in every single state, regardless of like how good you may think it is. I mean, here in New Jersey, there are so many things that we can improve. There are so many things that we can do to continue to move the ball forward compared to, you know, Idaho or Kansas. There are a lot more things to do, or there are different things to do. But what we found that was really stunning in our data collection was that this is not a problem that's isolated to, you know, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. Like there are problems, there are stigma that people face in every single state in this country. And it kind of takes different forms depending on where you're at. And it's something that we have to confront all across the country. And the only way to do that is to have activists trained and ready to go to get out there and put a really positive face on who atheists are in America. That helps reduce the stigma, but it also helps us build effective coalitions to advance good bills and to stop bad ones. And that's what we've been focusing on for the last 2 years.
All right. Very nice. And let's shift gears a little bit. What's your background? Have you always been an atheist, or did you grow up religious?
Well, I didn't grow up religious. I don't know that I would have used the word atheist when I was younger. I certainly wasn't religious, though. My parents are, I don't know, nominally non-denominational Christian-ish, I guess. I don't know. They I'm from Michigan. It's like we don't talk about like religion and money and politics. You know, like the, for whatever reason, it's just like it's impolite, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, so kind of vague mainline Protestant.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, exactly. And I think my parents were married in an Episcopal church, and that's the last time they've been in a church for a religious service. When I was growing up, I could count on one hand the number of times that I was in a church for something that wasn't either a wedding or a funeral. And I think if I used both hands, I could probably then count weddings and funerals too. Like even those were usually somewhere else. And so it was weird when something was being held at a church. Okay. And so, you know, and I'm from like rural Michigan, like farm country Michigan. And, you know, so religion was just one of those things that was maybe assumed, but wasn't really talked about a whole lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was certainly not raised religious. I would not have called myself a believer, even when I was younger, but I don't know that I would have, that I had the vocabulary to say atheist at that time either. It wasn't until, you know, college when you really start doing philosophy and religious studies that you really have the vocabulary to articulate your views on some of these subjects. And that's kind of when I was like, oh, atheist. Okay. That makes sense. I understand what that means now.
Out of curiosity, where in Michigan?
Lapeer is the name of the town. It was maybe 20 miles away from Flint. So kind of in that area, the thumb region of Michigan, if you're holding up the hand, kind of looking at things.
I figured I'd ask that way, since this is a audio medium, as you're opposed to asking on the Mitt.
For those of you listening, we can see each other, but you're not able to. If I held up my hand and pointed, I don't think it would be, it's not good radio, so I wouldn't do that. But it's maybe like an hour and a half to 2 hour drive north of Detroit.
Okay,
so you get like, if I fly to Detroit and I get in a car, I can basically just drive north for an hour and a half or 2 hours, depending on traffic. We in Michigan, we talk about everything in terms of like how long it takes to drive there. We don't like use miles that way. As opposed to out here, that was a big change for me in New Jersey, where they would say, oh, it's, you know, it's like an hour and a half drive. Oh, so it's 60, 70 miles. Oh no, it's like 15 miles. Like, wait, what? that's a very different conception of distance. Yeah. Here in the kind of dense Northeast, it's a little bit different.
But, yeah, and out in the West, we also do time.
You do time, yeah.
Because
you can drive 80 miles an hour. Yeah,
well, sometimes you might be doing 80 miles an hour down the freeway, but you might also be doing 45 in the mountains.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, 55, 60 in the mountains. But yeah,
depending on if it's snowed at all in the last, you know, few minutes.
And in parts of Idaho, you might be going on gravel.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of grew up in that, I don't know, that apathetic environment that I think a lot of people in that age band, you know, grew up in, where it certainly wasn't steeped. My life wasn't steeped in it. But at the same time, it was certainly an ever present part where there was that assumption that, course, everybody just goes to church, but nobody knows where you go. Like, it's not a big deal. You know, it's not something huge. And then, you know, I was in the Scouts, and I am an Eagle Scout, and that was a big part of growing up. But the Scout troop I was with was chartered from a public school. And so we were not religious. the Boy Scout troop I was part of did not do the religious stuff. And in fact, we had some Scouts join us that were from a pack, you know, Cub Scout pack. That was out of the local Catholic church, and they joined, and they were nice. And, you know, I'm friends with many of them still. And we were talking, and, you know, they said, oh, are you guys going to say grace before, like, we went the first camping trip we took with this new group of kids. I'm like, oh, who says grace? Who's your chaplain's aide? And I was like, the what? The who? says what? And so, like, it was just, it was a completely foreign, like, thing to us. The assumption that there was, like, anything to do with religion in Boy Scouts was very foreign to me until I started, like, getting out more into the broader range of scouting. And learning more about, you know, the really strong element of the Mormon Church in the Boy Scouts of America. I went to a scout National Scout Jamboree and seeing the groups from Salt Lake City that, you know, rolled up with their, you know, just immense amount of funding, and they had just hundreds of kids when we're coming from, you know, Flint, the Flint area, and we have 40 people with us, and they show up and they have 400 from Salt Lake City, you know, and that was very interesting to see the difference in the way that that was done. And just, you know, learning more about the power structures and the way that the Mormon Church had really kind of gotten into the scouting, the scouting movement in the United States. So that was a culture shock, certainly, but I was certainly never religious, and I never really, I never hid it. I didn't, like, you know, couch it at all. Even when I was in Scouts, like, we would have these conversations, and it just, it was not an issue at all. But, you know, after college, I went and worked on the 2008 presidential campaign down in North Carolina, and then worked on, worked in politics, worked in nonprofit fundraising for a few years. And I was just, I was kind of tired of towing the party line on certain issues, where, you know, I'd gotten into politics. I'd gotten really interested in this work, in part because of the timing. You know, the political awakening for me was during the Bush administration, and the abuses that I saw during the Bush administration of things like, you know, warrantless wiretaps and, you know, drones and, you know, all the civil rights and civil liberties issues that I was really concerned about at the time. Yeah. And that was kind of the big one, but also the, just the weaponizing of religion, in, you know, all these, state constitutional amendments banning gay marriage. I mean, that was 2004. And people forget that that's like, that's how recent that was, that we were not just were same-sex couples not able to get married, but we were affirmatively banning it in 2004.
Yeah. It was in like, what, 20 different states that year alone?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they used it as a political tool to turn out evangelicals. And so, like, that was what drove me to want to get involved in politics. And I did. And, you know, when the Obama administration came in, and you know, we were excited. But then they continued some of the same things that I was really concerned about. They continued with, you know, the drone strikes, and they continued with the wireless wiretapping, and they continued with the expansion of executive power. And the things that at the time we were really concerned about because it was George W. Bush. And, you know, your principles don't go away just because the guy who's occupying the chair is a nice guy, right? If you're serious about your principles.
And, right. And you don't want to have a benevolent dictator, because if you get a malevolent dictator, the power is there.
Yeah, the power is still there. And that's, you know, I certainly trust, I think I trust Barack Obama's judgment on a number of topics more than I trust Donald Trump's judgment on similar topics. But no one should have that ability to make those judgment calls. We've gotten to a point where, you know, where the presidency has all this power, and the Congress has ceded a lot of it to the presidency, and that's not a great spot to be in. And so we just basically said, all right, I can't continue to justify this, and I need to go do something else. And what that was at the time was going out there and finding an area of the law, an area of policy, an area of politics that I was excited about, where I saw a nexus. I saw, you know, a common thread through a lot of these issues that I was really passionate about. And that was church-state separation, the intrusion of religion into American political life. And so I went and I worked with the I applied for and got a job with the Secular Coalition for America. I was there for in DC for about a year and a half, and then came to American Atheist in 2012, and I've been there. I've been here since then. It's been, you know, it was been kind of a been a fun journey, but that's the stepwise of it. It's been, but that's my background, is you know, looking at these issues and, you know, being coming to my political sense of identity and growing up under this kind of pervasive sense of religion, and then this very explicit weaponizing of religion by the Bush administration, I think really pushed me in a particular direction. And so I guess thanks, George Bush. Thanks, Karl Rove, I suppose, for that particular strategy.
All right. And then I guess with all that, how hopeful are you for the future right now?
That's a complicated question. I'm not a fatalist. I don't look at stuff and go, wow, we're just completely screwed here. Nothing's gonna change. But at the same time, I don't want to pretend to people that the road ahead will be easy, because it isn't, and it won't be. Looking at the grassroots, looking at the people who are out there, especially looking at young people who are getting who are excited and are passionate and are engaged, there's no question that I'm hopeful for what they can do. The problem is that we've erected all these systemic barriers that keep them out of politics, that keep them out of getting engaged, that add cynicism to the mix, that make it very difficult to actually change anything. We've created a political system that isn't responsive. That's where religious issues are deeply entrenched in American public life, where religious privilege is entrenched in American public life, and where religion is often caught up in and mixed in with issues of race and class and all sorts of other things that make it very difficult sometimes to separate out what the quote unquote real issue at hand is here. You know, Christian nationalism, the idea that to be a real American, quote unquote, requires some level of Christianity, requires you to, you know, believe that the United States is a Christian nation, scares the hell out of me. The views of the people that espouse this view are horrifying. They tend to be outright racist sometimes. Mm-hmm. Usually, you can kind of trace a direct path from, you know, the Christian nationalists of today to the anti-abortion crusaders of the 1980s and 90s, to the pro Jim Crow and segregationists of the 1960s, yeah. To the, you know, just you can trace a line directly back to those groups, and there's a whole lot that's kind of wrapped up in that.
Right. Yeah. The Venn diagram of white supremacists and Christian nationalists is almost a perfect overlap.
just about a circle. Yeah. There are obviously some really terrible atheists who are white nationalists in there as well. The Richards Spencer of the world, but and some other people. But yeah, there's a whole lot caught up in all of that. And our politics has gotten to the point where people feel a level of hopelessness. And on some level, I can't abide that, because in order to do this job, in order to do this work, you have to believe that things can change, and that things can change from within the system on some level. And that requires some level of creativity, and that requires us to, yes, be hopeful, but also just to be dogged and unabashed, and to have no shame about going out there and demanding equality and demanding our rights. And sometimes that means working within the electoral system. That means being loud and being vocal and holding candidates accountable. Sometimes that means going out there and protesting. Sometimes it means going out there and, you know, putting your body on the line for what you believe in. And we have people who do that. I mean, we have people who, you know, go out and get arrested because they're engaged in civil disobedience for what they believe in. And, you know, what I tell people all the time is that any issue that you care about, and this is like the piece of advice I would give, anything that you care about, if you're an atheist, is an atheist issue. I think that over in past decades, we've been too hung up on, you know, what is an atheist issue? Like, are we diluting our message by talking about, you know, climate change or reproductive choice and access or LGBT rights? Well, no, because these are things that our community cares about. I mean, you survey our community, and, you know, I don't want to pretend that anything is unanimous in this community, but at the same time, you know, 90% of people are concerned about climate change and think that we should dedicate more resources to fighting it. A massive majority are concerned about public education and protecting public education. A massive chunk are concerned about reproductive access and LGBT rights and protecting children from religious harm. I mean, these are all issues that people care about, and it's not challenging, to draw the line directly from religious intrusions into public life to those issues. And so that's an obvious one, but those are pretty easy to say, okay, this is clearly an atheist issue or a church state separation issue. But for atheists who are concerned about their community, anything that you guys are concerned about is by definition an atheist issue. If you're concerned that your community doesn't have enough public transit, and that it's making it difficult for people to get around in your community, And people are suffering because of that, or, you know, there's homelessness and, you know, there's nothing that's happening. There's nothing that's being done to confront that in your community. If it's something that a bunch of you are at your local group are concerned about, it's now an atheist issue because mm-hmm. you care about it. You're atheists. This is your issue. So now it's an atheist issue. So you go to that meeting and you say, hi, you know, I'm Nick and I'm with the local atheist group. And this is something that I'm really concerned about. And I'd like to see some movement on it. And here's what you can do. And, you know, and find allies, find people that you can partner with. And you just might find people that are also atheists who didn't know that your group existed. But you also might find that there are lots of people in your group who share your concerns and are willing to go out there and fight for it. And that's what we need to do. I mean, you know, the local Methodist church, the members of the local Methodist church, don't spend a moment thinking and worrying that when they go to the local, the city council meeting or the board of education meeting, they don't spend a single moment worrying that if they say, hi, I'm Jane and I'm with the local Methodist church, that people are going to assume, oh, I didn't know that the official Methodist position on public transit was fewer bus stops. Like they don't spend a moment thinking mm-hmm. about that. They use it as an identifier to go out there into the community to demonstrate that they're engaged and that they're concerned about the future of their community. And that's what we need to do. We shouldn't be hiding and sitting there saying, well, we're going to have a speaker come in and talk about, you know, the historicity of Jesus, and then we're not going to do anything else until the next week or the next month when we have someone come in to talk about some other topic of academic interest. Like, you need to go out there and do more than that. I mean, it's great that you're bringing it, having people come in and talk about these issues, but what else? Like, how does that connect back to what I think is at the core of being an atheist, which is that this life is not a dress rehearsal for anything else, that this is the one we've got, this is the shot that we've got. And so it's our obligation as atheists to go out there and make it as, mm-hmm. as good as possible,
yeah.
to go out there and improve the world around us. And if we're not doing that, what are we doing? You know, we look around us and we see, you know, the country on fire in a whole lot of ways. Well, what are we doing to fix that? What are we doing to improve that? And if we take seriously that obligation as human beings and as atheists and as humanists to make the world a better place, then we need to think about ways that we can do that. Madeleine Murray O'Hare has this like really great quote, and I'm going to fumble it a little bit, but she says in the initial court filing for the lawsuit that she filed, the Murray v. Curlett, the original like case mm-hmm. that started American Atheist, where she says, you know, basically defining an atheist, right, and saying essentially like, this is what atheism means to me. And it's this really like powerful, moving quote. Let me just see if I can actually find the real quote here, because okay. I don't want to garble it because it is such a good one. An atheist believes that a hospital should be built instead of a church. An atheist believes that a deed must be done instead of a prayer said. An atheist strives for involvement in life and not escape into death. He wants disease conquered, poverty vanquished, and war eliminated. Like, That's how she defined atheism, how she defined what she called American atheism. And I think it's a great like starting point. It's mm-hmm. a great place for us to look to and say, and to push back on that idea that, you know, and it's a mischaracterization that the other side will use all the time, right? That atheists sit around and talk about how we agree that God doesn't exist, and that's the extent of it. Well, we shouldn't play into that either. We should go out there and do the thing. And, you know, we have members on our team and that's what they're focused on. Sam McGuire, who's our national field director, you know, will say essentially, you know, ignore, like forget the noise, go do the thing, you know? And that's like the one piece of advice. We're saying, like, Sam, what's the one piece of advice, you know, you'd give to the people out there wanting to be activists, is ignore the noise, do the thing. She says it with slightly more profanity sometimes, depending on the context, but that's the idea, is yeah. just go out there and yeah. do it. Don't get so hung up on, oh, are we doing this exactly right? Like, nobody's going to ever do anything exactly right. Mm-hmm. You do the best you can, and when you screw up, you apologize and you try to make it right. But go out there and do it. And that's if I could tell people just one thing to do, that's it. It's just go out there and do it.
Awesome. All right. Well, I think that's a good point to end it. Nick, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And atheist.org? Is it with an
atheists.
S? Atheists.
Yeah, with that S. Atheists.org. Yep.
All right.
I think atheists.org will get you there, too. I think we own that domain, too. But
okay.
Atheists is what you're looking for.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. We have gotten a fair amount of feedback, including another submission for the book contest. At present, we have as many entries as books to give away, so that's a good thing. I'm going to keep it open until our live stream in 2 weeks. You can get your submission in at contact@atheistnomads.com or on the feedback form at atheistnomads.com/feedback. If you'd like to get a hold of us for any other reason, you can also do that there. The feedback that we've gotten, and there has been a fair amount, we will be getting to next week. This week's episode has gone on long enough to push those off to next week. And if you want to support the show, you can find out how at atheistnomads.com/donate or at patreon.com/atheistnomads. Until next week, this has been The Atheist Nomads. And remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been The Atheist Nomads.